This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, it's time for Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom as she gives good tips for holiday baking. But we are going to start today with the fact that roughly 10% of people who get COVID experience lingering medical problems. They're calling it long COVID. In an excerpt from the Conversations on Healthcare podcast, we hear a discussion about long COVID with Akiko Iwasaki, a Sterling Professor of Immunobiology and Molecular, Cellular, and Developmental Biology at Yale University, and Fiona Lowenstein, editor of the Long COVID Survival Guide, How to Take Care of Yourself and What Comes Next, Stories and Advice from 20 Long Haulers and Experts. They speak with hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter.
Let's begin with you, Akiko. I wonder if you could share with us what we really mean when we say long COVID.
So long COVID is definitely a condition that is heterogeneous and variable. And it's difficult to pinpoint because we don't have a biomarker. But it's essentially a disease that happens after the acute phase of COVID that lingers over 4 weeks from the starting of the acute phase. And in some people, it's lasting for over 2 years now. And it contains multiple different symptoms. Over 200 different symptoms have been reported involving pretty much every organ system. And it requires more investigation.
Well, Fiona, let me turn to you. Doctors diagnosed you very early in the pandemic with COVID, and you were hospitalized in March of 2020, which really was the very early days. You recently wrote that you're dealing now with long COVID symptoms, but they're milder than most. Share with us, if you will, what you'd like to about your personal story with long COVID.
You know, I think one of the most important takeaways from my personal story is that privilege and access that I had as a, you know, white, economically privileged New Yorker with a primary care provider who knew me well played a huge part in my getting that initial COVID diagnosis, that test, the care when I needed to be hospitalized, and eventually, of course, understanding that what I was going through were most likely post-viral sequelae. It's been important to me to share my story as a way of sort of normalizing this experience, but also, of course, because I had that positive test and kind of that marker that did essentially prove that initial COVID infection. The symptoms that I deal with today are definitely on the milder end of the spectrum. It's crucial to understand that there are people with long COVID who are, you know, bedridden right now, who are not able to leave their homes. You know, there are folks who are using mobility aids to get around, and people who are also deteriorating and not making progress in their recoveries, although there are people who like myself, have experienced some level of improvement. I credit a lot of my recovery to my ability to take time off from work and rest and pace. And again, none of that would have been possible had I, you know, had children that I needed to care for, had I not had flexibility in terms of my financial situation and my work. And unfortunately, that's just not the reality for a lot of patients and not the reality for many of the patients who wrote chapters in our book.
Well, Fiona, thank you so much for sharing your story and your insights. Akiko, we recently had the Assistant Secretary of Health, Rachel Levine, as a guest, and she unequivocally stated that long COVID patients are not, quote, malingering. But as you know, there are skeptics. There was an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association highlighting data that raised questions about the very existence of long COVID, suggesting that patients' symptoms were in their heads. And I'm wondering what your observations of that article are.
Right. I'm just surprised to see that there are some skeptics that are still doubting the validity of this disease. So we've done a lot of immune profiling in people with COVID, long COVID versus those who recovered. And we're seeing distinct features of immune responses that are not found in the control groups. And so just by immunological features alone, we can distinguish people with long COVID. And it's very difficult to just imagine that.
Well, that is such an important message for people to hear. And I think probably very comforting to people with long COVID. But I want to pick up on the point about your guide, Fiona, which includes a focus on what you call medical racism and gaslighting. And indeed, the guide has received praise from patient advocates who say they've been ignored in the past because they're women or gay. You talked about some of the the benefits you appreciated from something of a privileged status in terms of access to healthcare and economics. But this is another whole dimension that can really harm people. What's the lesson here for the healthcare community?
You know, none of these issues are new, right? Inequal access to healthcare has been an issue, certainly in our society and in our country for a long time. And so I think it's important to understand that these structural barriers were very much here before the pandemic, but were, of course, exacerbated by the healthcare overwhelm that occurred and continues to occur on a seasonal basis when we have these huge surges, you know, case surges for now, not just COVID, but of course, we're seeing for, you know, flu and RSV as well. And so the stories in our books, we have stories from patients who came from communities that were disproportionately impacted by those high caseloads of acute COVID, right? We have a patient in our book who writes about getting sick in the first wave in an urban Black community in Baltimore and what it was like to try and fight for care continually. You know, we have a story from a Latina woman in Los Angeles, the same thing, trying to get doctors to take her seriously. And so I think for medical providers and for those treating long COVID, it's important to understand that some of those patients who don't have that initial, you know, COVID-19 diagnostic test or may not have that record of being treated for, you know, post-COVID symptoms may have been facing some of those structural barriers, you know, medical racism, medical sexism. These are very real barriers that existed prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, but have definitely been exacerbated by just the level of healthcare need that is going on right now.
Akiko, your lab at Yale is partnering with Mount Sinai Health System in a very important long COVID study that's looking at distinguishing features of long COVID that you've identified through immune profiling. I wonder what you could share with us right now about what you've learned so far.
So we are collaborating with people from Mount Sinai, especially Dr. David Petrino's group, and looking at deep immune profiling in people with long COVID, comparing that signature to people who recovered from COVID, as well as healthy controls who's never had COVID before. And what we're seeing, there are several key features that distinguish people with long COVID, such as elevated levels of exhausted T cells. These exhausted T cells are only found in people who are fighting chronic infections or cancer T cells that keep seeing the same antigen over and over. That's where we see these types of cells. We also see that there's evidence for elevated Epstein-Barr virus reactivation in people with long COVID. And another feature that's very uniformly different between long COVID and control groups is the lower levels of cortisol, plasma cortisol, we're seeing in long COVID patients. And because cortisol is such an important hormone that regulates so many different aspects of our physiology, we can basically assign a lot of the symptoms that they're, you know, getting with this low levels of cortisol.
We saw that you're also working with Dr. Harlan Krumholz at Yale on the LISTEN study, which stands for Listen to Immune Symptom and Treatment Experiences Now. I wonder if you could share with us the kind of data you're looking at in this study, some of the hypothesis you're testing out, and what's the timeline for making any results known?
Yeah, so the Yale LISTEN study is with Dr. Harlan Krumholz and a large team of investigators at Yale. And what we want to do with this study is to extend on what we did with Dr. Petrino at Mount Sinai and to really focus on different symptoms. For example, people with long COVID, as I mentioned, have over 200 different symptoms, but some symptoms are very debilitating, such as internal tremors and vibrations that people can't control. And that really affects the, you know, daily lives of these people. So we want to understand the immune features associated with these particular symptoms. The other group of people that we're investigating is post-vaccine related long haul. Some people are reporting that a similar symptom to long COVID can be seen in people who've gotten the vaccination. And we want to understand how that differs in terms of the immunological features compared to long COVID.
Fiona, we understand you're part of a patient-led research collaborative that is showing how you're adding patient voices to the data. What have you learned so far about making sure that patient voices are part of this important research?
That is a group that was born out of the Body Politics Support Group, which I started in 2020. So They're a group of patients with backgrounds in science and technology and medicine who basically started to observe these long-term symptoms in real time in their own bodies and in the anecdotes that people were sharing in this online support group in March and April and May of 2020. And they sought to survey that group. And so essentially did one of the first surveys that I'm aware of in the United States on long-term symptoms following a COVID-19 infection and provided us with some of that statistical data on, you know, at the time, I think the first survey was just, you know, a few hundred patients. They've gone on to, of course, work with much larger groups of patients, and they're affiliated now with several different research institutions. And of course, many of them have advised the NIH. I've spoken alongside them to the White House, as well as the World Health Organization. So I think what they're doing is really powerful, both in the sense that in many ways, they kind of raised the alarm on this issue. But they are also really changing the way that research is done. They are building on what HIV/AIDS advocates referred to as meaningful involvement of patients in setting research agendas and determining what research outcomes we should be prioritizing, you know, in terms of what we're looking for. And, you know, many of us may be aware of this, but what patients want to see prioritized in research is not always the same that's as right. what ends up, you know, getting researched. And so that's really what they're trying to do is bridge that gap. And so we have actually a chapter in the book written by Lisa McCorkle, who's one of the founding members of yep. the Patient-Led Research Collaborative, which aims to provide readers with those tools to understand and navigate emerging research, because patients are doing that. They're reading the research online. We want to make sure that they have the tools to basically understand what they're reading, vet misinformation that they might see pop up in these support groups or potentially in media articles.
You know, when I look back on 2020 and the beginning of 2021, certainly a happy day in the pandemic was when the first batch of vaccines arrived on our door. And the second happy day was when Paxlovid arrived on our door, and we had both a vaccine and we had a therapeutic treatment, and know that this has really helped. The availability of the antivirals has helped reduce the duration and reduce the risk of long COVID as well. But Akiko, I understand yet another study is the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs and the impact of Paxlovid. So tell us about that research.
Oh, sure. So the U.S. Veterans Affairs study basically looked at people who've gotten Paxlovid versus those who didn't, but had the same kind of pre-existing conditions. And essentially what they found was that people who took Paxlovid had a reduced risk of ultimately developing long COVID, whereas people without Paxlovid developed it more frequently. So this is a group of people that it's from the veterans, so the military population, and it may or may not apply to the general public, but it's an important study that demonstrates that curving the course of infection and replication of the virus inside the person could help prevent long COVID from happening.
But you've also, Akiko, been doing some groundbreaking work on the development of a nasal spray vaccine, which research shows would be more effective at preventing infections. And I'm wondering, you know, you think about Omicron, it continues to mutate. How do you balance those two? The nasal vaccine sounds very promising. But on the other hand, we continue to see this forever mutating virus out there.
Yeah, so the nasal vaccine actually holds some promise in that regard, because it can prevent transmission, or at least reduce transmission between infected people. And the more we can prevent transmission, the less likely that the virus has the, you know, opportunity to continue to mutate and evolve. And so that is why we're really pushing for this nasal vaccine strategy, because having the immune resistance right in your nose will prevent not only disease within that person, but transmission from that person to the next person. And that's ultimately how we need to think about controlling this pandemic, is to provide some sort of herd immunity so that the transmission can be reduced. And then ultimately these mutation, you know, will not be happening, because we can sort of curtail this spread of the virus throughout the world.
Are we in any clinical trial with the vaccine now? What can you tell us about timing? And people would be very interested in this.
Yeah, we are, you know, working very hard to develop this vaccine so we can do a clinical trial in humans. We currently don't have enough funding to be able to make the vaccine that's appropriate for a human clinical trial. It's difficult. I wish we had a warp speed-like effort to be able to deliver this to people, you know, as soon as possible, but we don't have that kind of support right now.
And I know that's a very important issue for scientists, that the lack of funding, and we'll keep an eye on Congress during this session to see if they can move the ball forward.
We hate to think you have to get out and do fundraising for something that is so desperately needed. I did note a few moments ago, you referenced Epstein-Barr virus, and we have been reading about how long COVID research might help us understand how better to treat multiple sclerosis or chronic fatigue syndrome, and we're very intrigued with that. I wonder if you could comment on that.
So COVID is just one of the many pathogens that can cause this mysterious post-acute syndrome. So long COVID is the latest to join that list, but there are a handful of viruses and bacteria and parasites that can similarly cause long-term symptoms. And so we're hoping that by studying long COVID, to be able to understand the parallel between these diseases and whether one research can inform the other, because the underlying pathogenesis may be shared.
Fiona, I want to end up with where you started, and maybe your best advice for people and family members dealing with long COVID. How can they find the best help?
Well, the first thing I would say is if you are experiencing or think you are experiencing long COVID symptoms, track your symptoms and also track your daily activities. I think in the support groups, we found it really helpful to look at not only when you're experiencing symptoms, but you know what might have predated that symptom, because a hallmark symptom of long COVID tends to be something we call post-exertional symptom exacerbation, the worsening of symptoms following a period of physical, mental, or emotional exertion. So that can be quite helpful as a starting point. There's a lot of great advice in this guide. I would say it's a good place to start. Dr. Iwasaki wrote a beautiful afterword as well, kind of sharing with the reader what the future of research for this disease might look like. But there's also a piece of advice that stands out to me right now from Dr. Donna Kim Murphy, who is herself both a provider and a long COVID patient. She writes that your provider should be your partner in your long COVID journey, and that if you are not finding that kind of intellectual curiosity and partnership in your provider, you deserve to find that, and you should pursue that by whatever means necessary. Obviously, everyone, we all have limitations in terms of time and money and access, but I think it's important for patients to feel empowered and know that that is what they deserve, and that there are providers out there, like Dr. David Petrino and others who are part of this book, who are really committed to forging that relationship with patients. There is not a patient-doctor divide on this issue. A lot of us are really working together, researchers, providers, right, patients, to solve this collectively. And so we're very grateful to folks like Dr. Iwasaki and Dr. David Petrino and others who are working with us to do just that.
Well, let's add Fiona to that list of people working together, Congress. And we know that Democratic members of Congress have introduced a number of bills to improve long COVID research, basically funding long COVID research and ensuring that there's access to care for people who are suffering. And to date, they haven't gotten Republican support. What are your thoughts on what the patient community and really all of us who care about this issue do to make sure that that funding for research and access is there?
Well, I'd say that, unfortunately, this isn't our first and likely won't be our last pandemic. I think it's crucial to think about pandemic preparedness on both a, in terms of legislation and on a societal level. Long COVID definitely opened my eyes up to the kind of liminal space in between full recovery and illness. And I think that that's a very important thing to understand, not just for a disease like COVID. That's a common experience, even, if you break your ankle, right? There's not always immediate recovery. I think that societally, we tend to be quite uncomfortable with that period of convalescence, with chronic illness, with disability. And so even as we move into the holidays, bringing those conversations out of the shadows and destigmatizing them and talking, with your family and friends about what are your COVID safety measures and understanding that this is a very personal issue. It's also a collective issue. And unfortunately, it's not something that's just going to go away, right? We like to compare COVID and the flu. ME/CFS may be related to long COVID, there are a lot of people who have been disabled by the flu as well, right? There are other post-viral illnesses. Long COVID is not the first of its kind. There are ways we can mitigate these sorts of problems in the future, and there are ways we can mitigate in the present. And I think talking about it openly is the first step to getting there.
ME/CFS. Why don't you say that, people?
ME/CFS, which is the abbreviated term for myalgic encephalomyelitis, sometimes called chronic fatigue syndrome. It's another often infection-associated complex chronic illness that shares many similarities with long COVID. In fact, a large percentage of people living with long COVID have qualified for the diagnosis ME/CFS.
Akiko and Fiona, thank you so much for shedding a light and illuminating this issue.
That was Akiko Iwasaki, a Yale University researcher, and Fiona Lowenstein, editor of the Long COVID Survival Guide, in conversation with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter of the Conversations on Healthcare podcast, which comes to us from the Community Health Center of Connecticut. Bird Note is next.
Hi, I'm Tom Russo. On the next Great American Folk Show, English folk artist Olivia Cheney. L.A. psych surf trio Pacific Sunset. Plus music from Minneapolis singer-songwriter Luke LeBlanc. And an interview with Ronnie Robbins, son of country royalty Marty Robbins. The Great American Folk Show. Listen Saturday at 5 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and lakes and rivers are starting to freeze over, but there is still a lot of open water out there. What do diving birds do once they are underwater? We learn in today's Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. By December, an extravagant array of diving birds that nested at far northern latitudes now bob on temperate waters across the continent. Loons, grebes, and ducks, goldeneyes, buffleheads, scoters, and mergansers float on the water's surface. Then they're lost to us as they disappear below. If we could watch them underwater, we'd see common loons racing like torpedoes, propelled by large feet set far to the rear of their bodies. Loons feed mostly within 20 feet of the surface, but can reach 200 feet and stay under for up to 3 minutes. Most diving ducks, though, are down and up again in less than a minute. Searching for food, they swim with their feet, sometimes using their canted wings to steer. A goldeneye dives under and swims about 10 feet from the surface, while scoters get down to 30 feet in search of clams and mussels. But if one bird stands out as the most beautiful diver, it has to be the long-tailed duck. Propelling itself beneath the surface with its wings, it seems to fly through the water, sometimes to depths of more than 60 feet. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Bird Note comes to us from the Public Radio Exchange. Sue Balcom is after this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Basin Electric Power Cooperative is planning an expansion of its Pioneer Generation Station in McKenzie County, and it is seeking a siting permit from the North Dakota Public Service Commission. Commission Chairman Julie Fedorchek says Basin is proposing to add
235 megawatt simple cycle combustion turbines and 6 18.8 megawatt reciprocal internal combustion engines.
That's a total of 583 megawatts.
They cite as the need for this that the service area in northwestern North Dakota is experiencing a rapid increase in the development for server farm facilities that host data centers and also cryptocurrency mining, as well as activities associated with oil and gas extraction from the Bakken Shale Formation, currently concentrated in McKenzie, Montreal, and Williams County.
Pioneer is fueled by natural gas. The PSC is planning a public hearing January 5th in Williston. ND Sober Ride provided 83 sober rides during the Thanksgiving weekend by giving out free Lyft codes to partygoers. Lauren Wallman, Safety Public Information Program Manager for the North Dakota Department of Transportation, says they are seeing a trend of around 80 free rides given per holiday.
Unfortunately, we don't know if they're repeating customers. They can't use the code more than once for the time period. But they may be using it in October, and then they may be using it again in November. And we actually hope that's the case. If these people are out at the bars, they're our target audience, and we want to make sure that they're getting home safe.
Wallman says the ND Sober Ride program will give out more rides for Christmas and New Year's. She hopes more people will start using the program.
We haven't been able to really compare to see how much of a difference this program is making compared to DUIs. We hope that after running this program for a few years, we'll be able to compare and hopefully see some correlation between them. But we are on a downward trend overall over the past few years with DUIs, and I think that is in large part because of these rideshare services.
And Minnesota's State Board of Investment is charting a path forward with climate change as a priority. After a series of presentations and reports from an outside consulting firm, the director of the Board of Investment, Jill Schertz, says that board will review current and future investments with an eye toward carbon impact.
We accept that this is an important and complex topic. Our expectation is that we'll develop a roadmap for establishing an appropriate strategic framework for climate change risk and energy transition opportunities. And in the meantime, we want to assure you that we're clear regarding our duty as fiduciaries. We are charged with considering all material risks and opportunities, and we will continue to do so in our everyday work.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and other members of that investment board have been urging Minnesota to limit investments with long-term carbon risk exposure. Walz says this move by the board is a good first step in the right direction. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Boucher, Realtor with Hatch Realty, brokered by Real. Serving home buyers and sellers in the Fargo-Moorhead Metro, Grand Forks, Bismarck, Mandan, and Detroit Lakes area. Josh can be reached at 701-369-4839 or hatchrealty.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now from our Bismarck studio is root seller Sue. Sue Balcom joins us once a week for Main Street Eats to talk about food. Sue, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. Well, happy December. Through November.
Yeah. And Thanksgiving. I hope we all had wonderful Thanksgivings. My son actually spatchcocked a turkey and smoked it this year.
Mm.
And I'm like, this is so cool. It was so super good. So apparently that spatchcocking thing is really catching on.
That's like a way of cutting it, right? So
correct.
That it cooks faster?
Yep. Actually, you can do a great big, you can do a 10 or 11 pound turkey in about an hour and a half.
If you
cut the backbone out and flatten it and then fold the lesser fat parts under the turkey. And then what I do is I lay it on top of a rack on top of the bread cubes and onions and stuff for the stuffing. And then you roast it at a really high temperature until it's 165 or 70 degrees. And then all that flavor is dripped down into that bread that gets all toasty brown. It's like just delightful.
That does sound really good. Well, yeah, I love that there are really simple things that you can do that kind of elevate your food experience, especially as we go into
baking season.
Baking season, yeah.
It's the great British baking season.
Is it ever not baking season in Sue Balcom's world?
No, and you know what? There are days when I'm thinking to myself, God, I wish my house wouldn't smell like a bakery all the time. I'm getting sick of this smell. But JC's gets up in the morning. He's like, oh, it smells like apple pie in here. yeah, super cool.
Yeah.
So, we should talk a little bit about baking because this would be the season about cookies, right?
Yeah.
Cookies. And, actually, I met this gal from she moved here from Maine, and she took 3 months of baking at this school in Paris, and she made a stollen for the farmer's market the other day. And so I bought a stollen, and I hid it in the refrigerator. And this morning I was like, oh, I think I have to try this stollen. And I cut it, and my husband, I offered him a piece, and then he came back and got two more pieces. And then he came back and said, why don't you give this woman a tip? I said, that thing cost me $25. I'm not giving her a tip. And so I imagine by the time I get home from running errands one day, it'll be completely gone. But that is a super great German kind of bread that has nuts and candied fruit in it. And I know a lot of people don't like fruitcake. I, on the other hand, love fruitcake. This would be the next best thing because it has more dough and less sticky fruit and nuts in it. So on the side there, that was just my experience. So what should we do? We're going to bake some cookies, right?
Okay,
this is the
sure.
time of year when I bake Pfeffernuss cookies.
Okay.
And I am on my, let's see, I
baked, those kind of puffy spice cookies that
yes,
are brown and
have,
covered with a lot of powdered sugar.
Yep. And lots of honey and coffee and lots of spices go in there. And, of course, I always tell people that they're better when they age because they really are. But they never last that long to age. But one of the things that you do with cookie dough like that or any other spicy cookie dough would be to put it in the refrigerator. I make a lot of doughs in advance when I feel like I'm going to have a great day of baking. But the best thing you can do is make your doughs like ginger cookie dough, gingerbread dough. A lot of sugar cookie doughs require refrigeration. If you're going to leave them in the fridge for a couple days, good. If you're going to make them a week or two in advance, put them in your freezer.
Okay. Why? What happens? What's magical that's happening in the fridge?
It's called marriage. You know, like
marriage is so magical all
yes,
the time.
Yes, marriage is magical. So what happens, and this, you know, I've discovered these things quite by accident, but, you know, pie crust, anything that has flour in it, the flour needs time to absorb the liquids. The consistency changes. It's easier to shape cookies when their dough is cold. You know, like your cookie cutouts always have a sharper edge when that dough is cold. And never, oh my gosh, people, never use a fresh out of the oven warm cookie sheet to put your new dough on. That causes that dough to heat up very fast and it kind of melts into the pan. Not good. But your flavors marry by aging the dough and your flour gets a chance to be completely absorbed into the dough. And so it's always a good thing to do anything like that. Even bread doughs can be put in the refrigerator and they will still rise, but they will rise in a different way than they do on the counter. So if you have room in your refrigerator, I know some people don't have the luxury of having two refrigerators in their house, but I do and I make total use of it. So another thing you can do, instead of using vanilla, if you're out of vanilla, you know, you can use a flavored liqueur instead to flavor your cookies. And I know that there are tons and tons and tons of different flavored boozes out there.
Mm-hmm.
Too many for one person to taste all the time.
Yeah, I just threw some whiskey in with a sweet potato pie over Thanksgiving.
Oh,
that was some next level sweet potato pie.
I want some sweet potato pie.
I forgot about that.
That stuff is amazing.
Dream well, about it.
I made pumpkin pie from scratch this year that turned out divine.
I bet.
And then I used the sweet potatoes. I cooked a vegan Thanksgiving dinner. With the exception of the ham, but, you know, there were guys there. They had to have ham, but everything else was vegan.
Sure,
so
okay.
We made a sweet potato casserole with candied walnuts on top and sliced apples. Oh, my gosh, was that ever good. I could probably be a vegetarian. Maybe not vegan, but I could be a vegetarian. Oh, another sidetrack. Okay, back to the vanilla, back to the dough. Okay, one of the things, too, like if you do cut out cookies, I like sugar cookies. I don't like 2 inches of frosting on top of any of my cookies because I like plain old cookies. So if you're going to decorate your sugar cookies, you can do a couple things there. One of the tips for any kind of royal icing or chocolate drizzle that you do is to put a tablespoon of white corn syrup in the mix.
Did you say white corn syrup?
Yes.
You must have said light.
The light. Well, okay, it isn't white. It's clear.
Oh, okay. No, I was just like, I've never heard of white corn syrup.
We have white corn syrup and black corn syrup.
Okay. Gotcha.
Oops, sorry. Yeah. You're right. It's light corn syrup. And it's getting, that stuff is getting hard to find.
Really?
I cannot. Yeah, I ordered the dark stuff.
All the processed foods.
No. Now, let's clarify that right
okay.
now.
Okay. Not the same thing.
It's not the same
okay.
thing. Okay. Corn syrup that I use that comes in the bottle, Carol, K-A-R-O, I think, is the brand name. That is a true corn syrup.
Gotcha.
High fructose corn syrup is a totally different beast. It is manufactured different than the corn syrup, and even though the names are the same, there's a molecule or so missing in one of them that makes your body think that it's not full, which is why high fructose corn syrup is not necessarily a good thing to consume or overconsume in, you know, like sodas and things
tendencies
like that.
Tendencies to overeat.
Yeah. Oh, God, we've been, I made Chex Mix and... A bucket
it's
of Chex Mix, and overnight it's a half a bucket of Chex Mix.
That's a thing.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, I'm going to wait till closer to Christmas to do that. But
all right, you sent another tip list here. What does crumpling your parchment have anything to do with successful baking?
It's called taming your parchment.
Oh, okay.
Your parchment. You know when you pull
wild?
It off? Yeah.
What?
You pull it off the roll and it curls.
Yeah.
And it curls the wrong way always. And so one of the two things that I do is I either take my hand and I dampen the pan or the counter and make it stick to that. When I always like to bake my cookies on parchment because I don't like to wash my cookie sheets very often. And then, so if you crumple it, that will also kind of like soften it up a little bit. And then, of course, one day I caught my husband throwing my parchment paper away, and I'm like, whoa. We reuse that till it falls to pieces. So, crumple your parchment, put it in your baking pans. I have some classes with people, and we were talking about using parchment paper, and this gal's like, but I use parchment paper, and it stuck to all my cookies. I'm like, you were using wax paper.
Mm-hmm.
Do not confuse the two. Wax paper will not work the same as parchment to line your cookie sheets with. So
now, Sue, when you said you don't like to wash your cookie sheets very often, is that just like... You bake so much, you just don't want to do too many dishes? Or is it not so good for your pans to wash them too much?
You know, I know people are, like, appalled by the fact that their pans don't stay shiny.
Oh, yeah.
You know, whether it's your cookware or your bakeware. But when you put a shiny thing in the oven, the heat reflects off of it. So, like, baking a pie in an aluminum tin, I hate that because the bottom never browns as well as it does in a glass or a metal pie plate because the darker they get from using them, the more heat they absorb. And one of the differences between professional ovens and home ovens is you cannot get your heat as high or as consistent because of the way they're made. They're not made for industrial use, even though I use mine way more than a normal person.
You probably need a professional oven.
I would love to have one, but somehow I cannot talk the guy into remodeling the kitchen for me. So in the meantime, I might have to just settle, right?
You seem to be doing a good job with
your oven. I am. I've actually done, 25, 50 dozen Pfeffernusse cookies for farmers markets.
Good night. 55-0?
50,
oh
yes.
My gosh.
Yes.
Nuts.
So each of those batches makes about 12 dozen cookies, you know.
Wow.
And like my grandmother's recipe says, it's like makes enough cookies to fill a cream can. So that's how we measure the number of cookies.
Yeah. So you definitely know what you're talking about when you talk tips. Now, you sent another one here that is milk powder and then toasting it. What does this do?
Well, you know, first of all, if you have recipes that call for liquid milk, like a bun or a bread recipe or a stolen recipe, you want to make sure that you heat that milk up to nearly boiling. It's called scalding your milk because there is a protein in there that actually will kill yeast off. So if you're making a yeast dough, that's one of the things that you need to keep in mind, that that's what scalding your milk does, and you have to do it. But the milk powder, if you toast it, you know, anytime you toast or roast something, the flavors deepen, the sugars kind of caramelize, and you get like a way better flavor. And they're not talking about putting it in your toaster, my dear. Do not put your powdered milk in your toaster to toast it. You do those kinds of things in pans over medium to medium high heat, and do not walk away.
No,
do not walk away from milk.
Not even
remember
one
that?
Second. Not you one can't. Second.
No, you just stand there. You force
it's
yourself
like
to stand
worse than a toddler
there.
With a marker.
It's just awful. You know, it's like, oh, I can turn around
no,
and measure
cannot.
The flour. No. By the time you're done, it's all over your range. So like toasting nuts, like I toast nuts, my walnuts, my pecans. I toast my sesame seeds before I put them in bread, sunflower seeds and things like that. Just gives them a much better flavor. So that you can replace your liquid milk with powdered milk. It gets lighter because the water, like the too much water and the intense concentration of those milk sugars, which is why you don't want it to run over on your stove, you know, are better for your dough when they're in the powdered form. These are some of the things that, you know, like I always keep a box of powdered milk in my pantry. You know, sometimes when you run out of something, it's always good to have like a pantry full of emergency things. And powdered milk is one of those things that really comes in handy. Even though my mom made us drink half cow's milk and half powdered milk when we were young. And I hate the flavor.
Yeah,
maybe toasting it would have been better. So
toast your milk.
So anyway, you're getting the benefits of the milk, the sugars and the proteins and stuff like that, without the extra water, which could definitely weigh your dough down. Now, you might have to experiment with it, but you might also be able to Google how much the proportion is to replace the powdered milk with the liquid milk in your recipe.
Okay. What about presentation?
Oh, I only eat naked sugar cookies because I can't decorate very well. But if you do want to pull a Martha Stewart at the last minute, one of the things, and I'm up front with people about this. I'm like, okay, I like sugar cookies. I like gingerbread cookies. Mm-hmm. I like decorated cookies. But you're not going to see those
decorate them.
Detailed little things on there. So I have something I do that I call the Jackson Pollock method of doing sugar cookies. And your kids might actually really like this if you have kids, where we lay the cookies out on parchment or wax paper, cover the table, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you make your royal icing with that tiny little bit of corn syrup in there, which will make them glossy.
Okay.
And then use gel food coloring. Gel food colorings are so much more intense than those liquid ones that they used to have
gotcha.
In the 50s.
Okay.
And you can buy them one, you know, color at a time. So I have a black and I have an orange. You know, I have basic colors in my refrigerator or in my pantry for Halloween, and then the reds and the greens and yellows for Christmas. So then you mix that up and you make it a little bit runnier than if you were going to pipe it. And then you take a spoon or a brush or a old catsup bottle, maybe they don't make catsup in those squeeze bottles anymore. Squeeze bottles. You can buy them at the dollar store. And fill those up and let your little ones drizzle or splatter. Now, I use that term loosely, splatter, because what you don't want is it on your walls and floors and stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, it would be so much fun, wouldn't it?
Load a toddler with a...
with a brush and some icing. Go,
frosting.
Go.
Gun.
And so that's one way that you can do those. Another thing you can do with that same frosting is dip them. You know, like you'd have a star cookie and you could dip it halfway into the icing and then put it on a rack to finish dripping and dry. Or you could hold it very carefully upside down and dip the top of it in. But one of the easier things to do if you want a colored cookie is to put the gel coloring in the sugar cookie dough. You know, you can make beautiful yellows and greens, you know, for trees and red for boots. And then you just have to do a little bit of fancy icing on there.
Mm-hmm.
It works with, does not work with a dark colored dough, though, the icing in or the color in the cookie dough. So those you have to do
on there's no
your
dyeing
own.
A gingerbread cookie.
Right. And then, of course, any other kind of cookie like, let's see, they have, the powdered sugar on like Mexican tea cakes and stuff like that. That's kind of pretty. My grandmother used to make a honey cookie and she would just take a white, beautiful white icing and spread it on top and then put sprinkles on. Just keep in mind that some of us older people don't like to crunch those down. When your teeth get a little older, they're a little more sensitive to those tiny little beads that people put on cookies and stuff. But here's my favorite. You can do all of these things with chocolate, too. Like you can gently melt chocolate. If you melt your chocolate too much, whether it's in the microwave or over a double boiler, it will seize into some raggy stuff. But don't throw that away because that you can bust up and put into your next chocolate chip cookie recipe. So nothing ever goes to waste at our house.
No, I guess not.
But you can put a little bit of corn syrup in with that chocolate also. When you warm it up, gently warm it up, and that helps thin it out. It will also make it really nice and shiny. And then you can dip your cookies in there. You can drizzle that on your cookies. You can frost your cookies and put chocolate shavings on using a vegetable peeler if you want. It's just an easy way to make pretty cookies without having to be so, I don't know what the word would be, like intense about decorating.
Yeah, it's a mindset.
It is.
Now, I like to sprinkle just a little bit of a finishing salt on certain cookies. It's just a nice way to do that. But what about, like, when you're making a pie and sometimes it calls for an egg wash, sometimes you need milk, what is the difference?
The difference would be what you actually have on hand at the moment you're baking.
Yeah, right?
But here's one that I just discovered. Actually, there's a couple of different colors that go with the milk versus the egg yolk. You know, like an egg yolk in its totality is really a nice yellow or kind of orange depending upon the egg and the time of year. And you can use straight up egg yolk to give your sugar cookies a wash or your buns a wash or your pie crust a wash. And I don't usually wash, you know, like I'll wait until something is baked and then I will go and do the wash on it for the kind of the finish.
Oh,
so the egg yolk will make it yellow. The egg white then, of course, will be an easy wash for like over a pie crust, and then you can sprinkle sanding sugar over the top of it and give it that finishing bake, and that'll be glossier and not yellow. And then, of course, the whole egg, of course, if you don't want to waste A or B, like if you're not baking 20 pies, you can mix the two of them together and kind of get in the middle there.
Okay.
But you can use cream and a little water. You can use milk and a little water. But what I discovered the other day, quite by accident, when I was baking buns, you know, everybody likes my buns. I have an enriched dough bun that I make. It's got sugar in and fat and milk in it. And it's so they're so tender and so delicious and slightly sweet in the first place. So if you take even parts like a quarter cup of sugar and a quarter cup of water and you put that in the microwave till that sugar is completely dissolved and then glaze your buns right before you take them out of the oven with that, it adds a nice gloss and the tiniest little bit of sweet to the actual top of that bun. Oh my gosh, they were amazing.
And once again, we are hungry. Sue Balcom joins us once a week to talk about food. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, Ashley. It was my pleasure.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra presents an afternoon of fun for all ages on Saturday, February 5th at 3 p.m. in Ann Nicole Nelson Hall. Special guest Caitlin Vogel, Miss North Dakota, USA, will narrate Benjamin Britten's Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. High school soloist Hayden Fredrickson will perform David Gillingham's Concerto No. 2 for marimba and orchestra. Other works include the Jamaican rumba, Swedish polka, and much more. Live or live stream tickets are available at MinotSymphony.com or at 701-858-4228.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 1st. North Dakota's coal mines were dangerous places a century ago when blasts and equipment accidents could be fatal. The industry had swelled in North Dakota in the 1910s. In 1920, the state had 116 mines, most of them underground. They produced nearly 879,000 tons of coal, worth more than $2.1 million. That would be more than $33 million in today's dollars. The 1919 legislature established a coal mining code and created the position of state coal mine inspector. Safety concerns were a major force behind that legislation, understandably so. Here's a sampling of how dangerous mining was. In 1918, in a Beulah mine, an elevator cage struck a miner, breaking his leg in two places. He was hospitalized for over a year and a half. He sued. The case went to trial, and in 1922, a jury awarded him $20,000. In 1919, two brothers, ages 9 and 13, drowned in an open coal mine near Beach when one went wading and dropped into a deep hole. His brother tried to rescue him and also drowned. Neither boy could swim. Later that year, a man was killed in a mine near Washburn when a 400-pound drilling stem fell 25 feet, striking him with a glancing blow. And one man was killed and three others injured when a mine near Beach caved in. In 1921, a miner lost his leg to amputation when a mule balked while hauling coal cars at a New Salem mine. The miner tried to brace the three cars with his leg, but his leg buckled, causing serious damage. On this date in 1923, a farmer digging coal in a mine near Van Hook died when a block of coal fell and crushed him. Just days later, two men were severely burned in a mine blast south of Bismarck. One of the men later died due to his burns and from inhaling fumes. In 1924, a man narrowly escaped death in a mine near Beach after a premature powder blast caused injuries to his face and head and broke his shoulder blade. Fortunately, modern-day coal mining is much safer. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
What kind of a toll has the world's biggest sporting event taken on workers behind the scenes?
And the world should remember this while watching our favorite teams in these air-conditioned stadiums. It was made possible by these workers, literally the sweat of these workers.
Allegations of low wages and forced labor at the World Cup on the next morning edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. to 9 central here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, sugar. We eat a lot of it. And we are going to learn about the human trafficking and slavery that is associated with a lot of sugar production. We visit with reporter Sandy Tolan about a report that is airing this weekend on Reveal. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.